Mike McEntee. You're enjoying our wonderful heat wave here, double digits above zero. It's wonderful out until we get to the next couple of days. Gosh, you just heard Brett read the forecast. That's depressing as all get out, but we're almost through it. We're almost through it. You know, another couple of days of this, and then, oh yeah, it's January. Okay. Hey, headlines here. A judge says no more to Roy Moore, and Doug Jones is headed to the U.S. Senate from Alabama. Later in the show, we're going to dig into some of the obviously made-up claims of voter fraud in Alabama that Moore supporters were trying to use as evidence that the election was rigged. You'll find some of this stuff pretty laughable. And then, should Al Franken resign? We've asked that question a lot of times on this program. A poll of Minnesota voters says the answer is no. And we'll dig into those numbers as well. And then precinct caucuses are less than 6 weeks away. Yeah, that's right. One of Minnesota's indivisible groups that organized in the wake of Donald Trump's election is getting ready to flex its political muscles. We'll find out what's being done to prepare for Indivisible's first political test. But first, it is nearly the end of the year, and we still don't know if Donald Trump's campaign colluded with Russia to win the 2016 presidential election. But we do know the investigation is progressing, and the Trump administration appears ready to discredit one of the potential star witnesses in the case, former Trump National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Well, when we talk about national security and international affairs, the man I turn to is Jack Rice, former CIA officer who is just back from his trip to China, Thailand, and Cambodia. Hi, Jack.
Oh, great to be with you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you for taking the time. I know you're just turned around here from your trip. You're jet lagged. You're busy all day, but I'm glad you are available here to chat about this because this is the story of the year, if not the decade, that's twisting out here. And I'd like to get your thoughts on this, especially here. The latest development was that the Washington Post says that Trump's legal team plans to cast Flynn as a liar, seeking to protect himself if he accuses the president or a senior's aides of any wrongdoing. I want to know what you think about that strategy and if it could backfire on him.
Well, it's a great question. When I think about this, I mean, as a criminal defense attorney, my knee-jerk response is it's not shocking. Because I think of this in the context of multiple co-defendants in a case. Let's imagine two or three or four different people who are charged in the same crime. They all work together, and that one or two of those may actually cut a deal and they would actually plead guilty and even cooperate with the prosecutor. The remaining defendants would try to cast them as essentially lying for their own benefit, for their own self-serving needs, in order to make a jury potentially doubt their testimony. That's generally how it would work. But what makes this interesting and what makes this fundamentally different is how Donald Trump himself has treated Mike Flynn. What mm-hmm. we know is he has said, not just while he was working for him when he was running for office, but actually after he won the election, and even after he, quote unquote, fired him for lying to the vice president, he said he did a good job. He said he didn't do anything wrong. He said it was fake news. He said that Congress should grant him immunity. He said he might grant him immunity. And he said that he didn't do anything wrong. So the problem is if he's such a great guy, how can you call him a liar subsequently when you knew he was a liar and he was still a great guy and a good man? And therefore, you can't have both. You can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't. People won't accept it.
I mean, that is the way this president kind of has tried to do everything, is paint somebody as horrible and then try to make a deal with them. You know, It seems it's a pattern on a lot of different levels. It's a bullying pattern. I don't think you can bully Michael Flynn into not talking to the FBI when apparently he's already cut a deal here.
Well, if we look at where we are with Mike Flynn, and it is true, if you think about the deal that Mike Flynn seems to have been able to work with Mueller's office, what he has is a plea to one count. And that one count is lying to the FBI. There's a whole series of things that he could have faced in this case. And in fact, what we're hearing, at least the rumblings, are that pleading guilty to that one count, he's looking at anywhere from 0 to 6 months in custody, and likely potentially closer to that zero mark. That's extraordinary, let alone the fact that it's possible that his son has also been excluded from prosecution because of this agreement. So clearly he has a motivation. And yet at the same time, one of the things that the Mueller team would have done as prosecutors in this case is they basically would have said, look, if you're going to cooperate with us, you give us everything. They literally sit down with them and they make it clear this is what you've got. But they also are going to have documents. And those documents are something that it's hard to ignore. It's hard to dismiss them because they're objective. And any fact finder would look at this and say, yeah, you can go after Flynn all you want. But the problem is the evidence speaks for itself.
I mean, where is this likely to go? I mean, could this, I mean, obviously there's other people who know something. That's why the FBI wants to cut a deal with Flynn. But who are they trying to get to? I mean, is it Donald Trump himself that could be behind all of this? Or is it more likely that it's going to be some of the other people surrounding him?
Well, I think it's getting closer and closer to the president. I mean, what's interesting here is that Ty Cobb, this is the president's attorney, came out when Flynn took this deal and admitted to the plea. He said he called him a former Obama official. He said, well, he only served in Trump's administration for 25 days. Those were his statements specifically. Of course, it's laughable because he was his senior foreign policy advisor. And specifically, he was the point man when it came to Russia. He was the one directly connected to these issues. He was the one that the president turned to on all of his national security issues on top of it. So the idea to call him somehow inconsequential and to make the claim that he was actually an Obama guy, which, by the way, strangely enough, gives him more credibility in many ways because he worked for all sides. And if he was the general and he was the good man and if he was the experienced guy who spent his entire career doing what it is that he has done, that gives him the credibility. But what makes this really interesting, Mike, is that if we think about what's really going on here, if you look at attacking Flynn, what you're really doing is you're doing this for public consumption. You're trying and playing to your base by making the argument that this guy needs to be ignored. The problem is that because this is a question of fact, that's something would actually play out in a courtroom. This isn't about that right now. What happens to Flynn and what he does is going to change the conversation down the road. You and I have discussed this before. The question of impeachment continues to come up. And the bottom line when it comes to impeachment is this: that is not a criminal process. That is a political one. And the real question that's going to come into play here is this, is will this Republican Congress, this Republican House, ever make a decision that Donald Trump costs the party more than it helps the party? Clearly, this is not a question of whether or not the party will put country above politics. They won't. That's clear. They've acted based upon that consistently since the election and before. Mm-hmm. This is about whether or not politically this hurts them to hold on to him rather than to jettison from the group. That's what we're waiting to see. And when Flynn rolls this out, when Mueller rolls this out with everything else that he has evidentiary-wise, that's the question that everybody has to watch, is to see exactly what the party will do when they calculate not just the midterms that are coming up this next year, but what's coming up 2 years after that. Of course, that potentially is the second term that this president could run for if he's in that position.
But the whole strategy of trying to make Flynn look like he's a liar and, you know, as you said, have it both ways, you know, that's playing the Trump's base. Isn't that really, again, when you're talking about this is that impeachment is political and not criminal, that's the natural thing for Trump to do, is to play to his base, to put the pressure on Congress so that he can continue to do whatever he's doing and not have to worry about the consequences?
Well, that is true. But again, back to that problem that he faces is you can't play both sides of the issue and continue with credibility. Remember, even his base is starting to break off at the fringes. You can look at his numbers now. The last poll that I saw was in the low 30s. Historically, we've never seen anything even close to this in the past. And while that may not matter technically right now because he's not running for anything, that matters a great deal to a third of the members of Congress who are running, because they're going to look at this issue and say, guess what? I can't win with 32%. I can't. I need to win with more. And by the way, for anybody who hasn't looked at that Alabama race and why it is that Roy Moore lost, it's not just the questions of the pedophilia issue. It was the questions of support and sort of consistency walking side by side with the president and whether or not that actually helped or hurt him. And those are questions that all of these other members of the House and, again, the members of the Senate that are also running and what that means too.
We're talking with Jack Rice here about what Donald Trump may or may not do in the Michael Flynn case. And the other tactic here, besides trying to paint Flynn as a liar, is just turning around and pardoning Flynn. That Flynn's family is pressuring Trump to pardon him, which would supposedly take the pressure off of Flynn to tell what he knows and possibly implicate others at the White House, including Trump. Is this, if he did that, would that be obstruction of justice, or does the president have that absolute power to pardon somebody in this case?
It's a wonderful question, because we are really in very new territory here. And realistically, he probably does have the authority to pardon Flynn, because we can look back at what it is that President Nixon was involved in. The bigger question has always been, can he essentially pardon himself? Does he have the ability? And the answer to that seems to be no. He doesn't have the ability to do that, but he does have the ability potentially to pardon Flynn. But, you know, that's not the bigger question. Because the bigger question here is that if he goes in and does that, depending upon the evidence that actually exists, you're going to get a large number of people potentially in the United States who are going to look at this and say, wow. And I'm not just talking about the left here. I'm talking about the centrists that really swung this election in many ways, who are going to look at this issue and say, this president looks dirty. Even if they were supporters because they didn't either like Clinton or because they were ambivalent for a series of other reasons, or because they liked what Donald Trump was saying. If you get something definitive or very close to definitive that makes him look dirty and it stands up objectively, they're going to have a hard time saying, yeah, I'm going to stand behind this guy, which will trip that question of the House, where they will come back and say, I can't support this guy because he's going to cost me my job. He's going to cost me my election. And that's a bigger question than the president from their perspective.
And then we've talked about this before. You're not surprised that this investigation is, you know, plodding along as opposed to moving at lightning speed, because, you know, they're trying to be nailing down all the evidence and making sure that, everything is exactly as it should be before the case is brought forward. But what can we expect to see? I mean, what are you expecting here now that we're almost into 2018?
If we look at where we are right now, believe it or not, to some degree, this has moved at, relatively speaking, and I say this very conscious of where we are, it's been moving quickly. Because what we have right now is we have two pleas. We have two that have been charged. We have his former campaign advisor and his former national security advisor. So we have those people, as well as a senior foreign policy advisor in Papadopoulos, that have already either pled guilty or have been indicted. So that's actually quite incredible. But what you're also likely to see now is this tightening of the noose on a series of other individuals. And I'm including the likes of a Kushner and on and on and on. Those are important, because the way you normally see investigations and prosecutions and conspiracy cases is you continue to tighten the screws and work your way up. This is not about working your way down the chain. Remember, you don't take deals, generally speaking, from those individuals and then try to get people who were their supporters. You get that, because those will follow in obvious course. But it's about going after people so you can go up the chain in their sources, go up the chain in terms of their superiors to see how high this goes. And that's clearly what Bob Mueller is doing right now.
Now, off the top here, I mentioned that you just got back from a trip to China, Thailand, and Cambodia. And I'd like your perspective here, since you've been out of the country. We've had almost a year of Donald Trump being in charge. How has that changed the view of the rest of the world of the United States, at least from your interactions you've had on your trip?
You know, when I look at this, Mike, I have to think about not just this trip, but I was teaching trial advocacy in Uganda last year, and I was talking to people in Africa and elsewhere sort of about the races back then. And then to talk to people in the last few weeks or month or so, and I'm including people from Southeast Asia, I'm thinking about some people I spoke with from Thailand, some people I spoke with from Australia, some other people I spoke with from some of the other countries, Vietnam. And I think what was amazing to me is that what they saw was that the United States is not particularly unique. I know it sounds crazy, right? What I mean is that what happens is I think the United States has always tried to see itself as, you know, the city on the hill, the city on the mountain, that we're unique, we're different than other countries. But the problem is what we have seen in many countries around the world is we have seen the rise of strongmen, the rise of totalitarian dictatorships. So I can take you into places like Indonesia. I can take you into places like the Philippines. I can take you into multiple countries in the Middle East, many of whom were supported by the United States over decades. The idea that the United States couldn't potentially see something like this. Well, guess what? What I saw from people, which I thought was really interesting, was that they saw this and said, oh yeah, this can happen anywhere. This can happen anywhere. And the idea that they're looking at the United States and saying, guess what? Welcome to the world, folks. Welcome to what it feels like to have somebody who potentially could be above the law. And I found that petrifying because, frankly, it was pretty spot on.
Yeah, the whole, you know, shining city on the hill type image that we have, of ourselves here in the United States, this is kind of our blind spot. That something like this could happen. And I think for a lot of folks who don't realize this is happening, I mean, that is still the blind spot. They believe that and don't believe that we could ever fall for it.
Well, when we think about the idea of American exceptionalism, and I mean, many people do this. It's not something just the Americans do, but I mean, many do. But the Americans are particularly impressive when it comes to their ability to do this. This idea that we're the best because we're America, which means we're the best. The circular logic makes no sense, because if you really want to sit down and look at statistically who we are and what we are, we're really only number one in a couple of areas. One of those is the per capita, the number of people that we put in prison. That's one of the major ones, in fact. And it certainly isn't when it comes to education or the ability to move societally or financially in terms of society or our ability to move economically. It's not about the issues that one might think they are. And if we know that we aren't exceptional, we need to realize that this experiment, this democratic experiment that we have in this country is only 200 years old. And we like to think of this in some way to assume that we were always here and we will always be here. Well, you know, I was climbing temples that are 800, 900 years old, that are essentially wastelands now. They were at the center of the earth in many ways, and now they're simply echoes of something that no longer exists. In China, there are thousands of years of history underfoot that no longer exists. And the idea that somehow we have this enduring freedom that will survive no matter what simply ignores the reality of history. The Romans lasted for thousands of years, and yet, according to Gibbon in 476, it died from decay from the inside out. This can happen anywhere, and this can equally happen in this country. I think we have to acknowledge that that is a reality, Because if we don't, then we're simply ignoring the very true reality that we face.
Freedom and democracy will only survive if we are vigilant. I think those are very, very true words, Jack.
You're right, Mike. You said it better than I did. Damn it, I better write that down.
I'm just summing up what you said there. Jack Rice, I appreciate you joining us via Skype today to kind of talk about what's been going on. Welcome back to the country. Get some sleep, and we'll catch up with you in the new year.
Thank you, my friend. Have a good day.
Okay. Folks, we're going to take a break, and when we get back, that poll about what Minnesotans think about Al Franken resigning. We'll get into that and other news of Minnesota coming up here next on the Mike McEntee Show.
Prairie Oaks Memorial Eco Gardens is the first green cemetery in Minnesota. It's a beautiful, peaceful place where burials are celebrations of life with as little impact on the environment as possible. Tony Weber founded it because he wants to leave a green legacy for his grandchildren, something many of us might feel. Learn more, visit the website mngreengraves.com. Give them a call. The goal is so meaningful, so positive, it might be right for you. Prairie Oaks Memorial Eco Gardens.
Stages Theater Company is dedicated to creating a space where diverse opinions, courageous dialogue, and community engagement is not only valued, but vital to our shared artistic and educational success. Stages Theater Company creates a welcoming home for all. For over 30 years, Stages has supported quality theater programming for children. Stages gives opportunities for youth to be on stage, backstage, in the audience, and in the classroom. Whether you come to see a show, enroll a young person in a workshop, or benefit from their outreach programs in the community, Stages brings art to life. Learn about Stages Theater by going to stagestheater.org and become part of the magic of live theater by taking your family to an amazing show or enrolling someone you love in an education program. Stages Theater Company operates out of the Hopkins Center for the Arts, located in Main Street in the heart of downtown Hopkins. For more information on Stages Theater, go to stagestheater.org. That's stagestheater.org.
Now on display at the Museum of Russian Art is an exhibition of beautiful icons and sacred art from the 19th century called Russian Sacred Art, Connecting Heaven and Earth. Liturgical music from the best Russian choirs gently accompanies your experience of these pillars of spiritual life. Open daily and with free parking, Tmura is the easiest museum to get to in Minneapolis, so plan your visit today at tmora.org. That is tmora.org.
Welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show. Next Tuesday, Al Franken will officially resign from the Senate. Well, most Minnesota voters, though, think that he should not resign. According to a new public policy polling survey of Minnesota voters, it finds that a majority don't think Al Franken should resign and that he remains popular in Minnesota, particularly with women. 50% of voters think he should not resign. Only 42% think that he should go through with his planned resignation. And there is little appetite from Democratic voters at the state level for Franken to go, with 71% opposing his departure. A majority of independents, 52% as well, think that he should not resign, just 41% favoring his exit. And he remains above average in popularity for a senator, with 53% of voters approving the job he's doing to 42% who disapprove. Now, the poll rarely finds senators with a majority approval in their home states these days because Congress, well, is just not that popular. But Franken's continued popularity is being driven especially by women. I guess we find that ironic, given for the reason that he's leaving. 57% of them like the job he's doing to 37% who don't. Just by contrast, Donald Trump stands at 40 approving and 58 disapproving with women in the state. So just kind of a view of, it tells us more about us, I think, than Al Franken in that poll. Now, a fallout of this, there will not be a special session before January 3rd. to change who becomes the new lieutenant governor next week when Al Franken resigns. A Republican push for a one-day session to prevent one of their own from ascending to lieutenant governor lacks the buy-in from the state's top Democrat, Minority Leader Tom Bach. And as we've heard before, Governor Dayton will not call a special session unless he gets agreement between all of the leaders, and that includes Tom Bach. So Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith will become U.S. Senator on Wednesday, and under the plan, Senate President Michelle Fischbach will slide into Smith's old role, and she is in a Republican in a narrowly divided Senate. She wants to remain a senator. That could prompt a court challenge. Republican Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka said he couldn't get Democrats to budge. And as I mentioned, only Governor Mark Dayton can call a special session, and he won't do it without a deal. And Gazelka says that's unfortunately because it could easily mean the Senate is in chaos depending on when and how everything goes down. That's because right now there is also another vacancy that gives, once that is filled, and if indeed indeed that Michelle Fischbach, it's decided that she cannot serve, we could have a tied Senate. And that would be an interesting power share agreement going on until that is resolved, because a special election for Fischbach's seat likely wouldn't be scheduled prior to the February 20th start of the 2018 session. And then this bit of news just in, breaking news. It was Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman had said that by the end of the year, there would be a decision in the shooting death of Justine Damon. Remember, a Minneapolis police officer, Mohammed Noor, shot her. And the question was he going to be charged in the shooting death? Freeman had said several times that he would make a charging decision on the case before the end of the year. But today he said that the investigation is not done and offered no timetable for when it will be completed. Here's the quote, and it's a quote off a piece of paper because he's not taking questions from the media. Mike Freeman says, "We are getting more information and evidence. An additional investigation must be completed. As I have mentioned before, the investigation and review of the case will not be rushed. It's more important to get it right than to get it done quickly." But he doesn't say what the additional information and evidence is, nor has refused to talk to investigators. Well, we are going to take a break, folks, but when we get back, we are going to dig into Minnesota politics and the push and shove that comes with the precinct caucuses, which are less than 6 weeks away. One group really wants to make a mark in that. We'll be talking to IREP next year on the Mike McEntee Show.
While shopping for a fireplace insert at Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces, I was amazed at all the choices. Not just gas, electric, or wood-burning, but also built-in or freestanding, and options in every style from antique to modern. The staff really listened to us, explained the options, and helped us choose a fireplace we absolutely love. Now it warms our hearts and our home every winter. Thank you, Woodland Stoves, for a great addition.
Hi, I'm Peter Solak, putting in a word for the EPA Burn Wise campaign. It has important information about clean burning fireplaces. This is an important part of our mission at Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces. We know that the fireplace has to work. Work with your life, work with your living space, and also be environmentally smart. Come see us. Learn to burn wise. We have over 35 working units on display at the corner of Riverside and East Franklin Avenue in Minneapolis. Visit our store in person or online at woodlandstoves.com.
Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces, out of the ordinary products and services since 1977.
The fine folks at Common Good Books will help you find the perfect book for you or the book lover in your life. Find a huge selection from a locally owned and independent bookseller in the Twin Cities. They are always bringing in top authors from around the globe for special in-store events. Open Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. and Sundays, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Find Common Good Books at 38 South Snelling Avenue in St. Paul or shop online at commongoodbooks.com.
What kind of a jackass would let an animal pick their insurance? Did you really think a lizard could save you money on car insurance? Would you let a duck pick your health policy? Insurance can be a zoo, but this is ridiculous. What you really need is an insurance agent that isn't looking out for the insurance companies. You need Cheryl at Array, an independent agent with 30 years experience looking for the best rate possible. Quit monkeying around and call 763-504-3067. That's 763-504-3067 for Cheryl at Array, representing you, not the insurance companies.
This is Ken Hagland of Minnesota Hospice, inviting you to listen to our brand new show airing on AM 950 on Saturdays from noon to 1. The Minnesota Hospice Show looks forward to discussing how we honor life and to exploring the physical, spiritual, mental, and emotional issues we experience throughout all stages of life. Learn how hospice is the new face of hope and how it's your benefit, your choice. Join us Saturdays at noon and check us out online at MinnesotaHospice.com.
Welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show here on AM 950. Checking the calendar here, precinct caucuses are less than 6 weeks away, almost 5 weeks. And one group that has that date, February 6th, circled on its calendar is IREB, the Indivisible Resistance of Eagan and Burnsville. Joining us now to talk about that is IREB organizer Mark Fresconi. Mark, welcome to the program. We haven't chatted in a while.
Hey, Mike. Yeah, it's good to talk to you again.
How you doing?
I'm doing real good. Like you mentioned, we're really focused on the precinct caucuses coming up. We've partnered with a local, with the parties both at the CD level and at the Senate district level. And there's a bunch of caucuses, caucus trainings coming up that we want our membership to attend so that they know what they're doing when they attend. And for those that can't attend, we're also providing them with information on how to participate, despite the fact that they won't be able to be there. You can still submit resolutions and requests to be considered for delegate and those kind of things. So we held actually one precinct caucus a couple of weeks ago. Was our first one, and then we've got our next one coming up on January 6th and 13th. Their Senate District 56 is going to be holding it at the Valley Ridge apartment building down in Burnsville in the meeting room from 11 to 1, again, January 6th and 13th. January 20th, we have another training at the Burnhaven Library, 11 to 1, and then on January 24th, the SD 51 training, which is our local Senate district, at the Westcott Library, 6:30 to 8. And of course, all this stuff is on our site. But we took a look at, you know, how things were going and, you know, what we were getting accomplished, and we realized that, you know, the biggest effect that we're going to have now going forward, at least in the short term, is getting involved in the process and making sure that we have our voices heard. And, you know, so we're getting pretty excited about that.
So what kind of impact do you hope to have at the precinct caucuses? And again, you're focusing on the DFL as opposed to any other party. You know, I'd like to understand why you want to do that, because you are a nonpartisan group.
Well, you know, we are progressives. The majority of our folks are progressives. Like you mentioned, we're nonpartisan, and we do have members that are not Democrats. And we let them know that, you know, a lot of this training and a lot of the ideas that we're talking about work just as well if they go to the Republican caucuses. But a lot of our folks want to have an opportunity to vote for progressive candidates. We have a lot of endorsements that are going on. And so, you know, in IREB, we haven't really, you know, been telling people who we think they should vote for. We decided intentionally to not become an endorsing body. Our members are, you know, have been endorsing candidates, but we wanted to be out of the way in that. We didn't want to be a distraction. And so, you know, we want to participate in the process, and we want to, you know, support it. And so, you know, because of the candidates that we want to see advanced, we're, you know, telling our folks to participate in the process and vote for the ones that they want. And so, you know, we just want to get as many people involved as who have not been involved previously. And, you know, that's kind of our target audience for the 2018 cycle.
Yeah, there's really three things that you end up doing in a precinct caucus. You can, as you said, you vote for a particular candidate, and that is in the sense that, you know, there's endorsements for, you know, legislature and endorsements for Congress. There's, you know, obviously statewide races this year. We have two Senate races, a governor's race. So there's lots of those types of things to vote for. There's also, you know, getting involved as a delegate to go to the next level. And then there's also putting in resolutions. And you mentioned that. Are there resolutions that you are supporting or asking people to support? Because those are really not so much about candidates, but about making change.
Right. And that's another thing that we actually have a training coming up. And let me take a look here. Our resolution training is going to be held on the 25th, I believe. I don't have that date handy. But we have a resolution class where we're going to actually be live streaming while we develop some resolutions together as a group, and then folks will be introducing them at the various caucuses because of the rules around having a resolution adopted at more than three locations. And so we're trying to get up to speed as fast as we can on the complexity of the process, but I think we're doing pretty good. We'll be getting a copy of the daily call to all of our members so they understand the dates and the process involved. And like you said, we'll be doing voting for candidates as well as part of the process, not necessarily at the first caucus, but as you move along, if you become a delegate or become an elected official, you move along and to the convention and then express your interest there at either your Senate district level or your congressional district level. And so, we're working real hard on that.
I suspect then you're encouraging people in IREB to become delegates and move up to the next level because that takes a little bit more of time and commitment as opposed to just showing up for one night.
Yes, exactly. We're telling all of our members that, when they ask who wants to be a delegate, all their hands should be going up because this is not one that we're going to be able to sit out. I was listening to your previous caller, and I'm just as concerned about the hands that our country is in as he is, and nobody can stay home this time. We have to get everybody out. Everybody has to show up, and even if we overdo it with the number of people we have, that's better than losing again.
So what are the people who are in IREB concerned about? I know there's the resolutions. People are going to meet. They're going to come up with various things. But, I mean, you've been with the group for a while. You have a general sense of what's kind of top of the agenda. What are the resolutions likely to address that are going to be introduced?
Well, one of the first ones that we're talking about, of course, is, the superdelegates. There's a number of people in the resistance that aren't real happy with that. And I think, there's some movement on that. But issues like single-payer health care are going to come up for us and college education and those types of things. All the main progressive issues we'll be drawing up issues on. And then we probably have some local things that people have, that we'll want to work on and get those involved in as well, too.
Now, you were going to have a town hall with Keith Ellison that was scheduled for December 20th, and that got canceled, of course, because, Congress was still meeting. Keith Ellison couldn't be here. Is that still going to happen?
Yeah, so we're working with Keith's office. We had to postpone that because of the tax reform issue and all that. And so we're probably looking to push that out towards the end of January, maybe into February. We're not real certain, whatever we can work with his break coming to town. We did invite Jason Lewis to attend our town hall that was scheduled for the 20th, but he turned us down immediately. So we don't expect that he will want to attend that.
You got a response saying he wasn't going to show up. That's more than you've gotten sometimes in the past. So,
it was a response from his staff. We hand delivered a letter that I had signed indicating when the town hall was going to be held, and that we would very much like our congressman to show up and participate. And the woman behind the counter just said, no, he's not going to show up. And it wasn't even, she didn't even take it, under advisement.
Now the Democrats are likely to end up with Jeff Erdman or Angie Craig running against Jason Lewis, because those are the two candidates, at least so far, that have announced, and they held their first forum here just recently. In fact, we'll be airing it here on AM 950 January 2nd at 10 p.m. I don't know, did you get a chance to go or watch or see any of that?
I watched the live stream from the uptake, and I thought it was a great forum. It showcased our candidates. They're both awesome candidates, and I can't wait to get behind the one that gets the endorsement and beat Jason Lewis.
Hmm. Okay. Do you think both have a pretty good chance if either one would be in the race?
Well, I'm like I said, I think IREB, we've wanted to stay out of the way with that. I'm going to let the people decide, who they think is the more prepared candidate for the race. I know both candidates and I care deeply about both of them. They're great people. They both care a lot. They have they're in the race for the right reasons, and they want to help the people in Congressional District 2 more so than the person that's currently representing us. That's for sure.
Fair enough. So we're speaking with Mark Frasconi from IREB, the Indivisible Resistance of Egan and Burnsville. Anything else that you've got going you want us to know about here?
Right now we're just focused on the caucus training and the resolution writing. And then once we get past the caucuses and we start getting into conventions, we're actually taking up the issues of our local state offices. We have a lot of seats that we need to flip down in CD2. So we're starting to pay attention to all those seats and these great folks that are stepping up and wanting to run. We've got some new people that are looking to flip seats all over CD2. We've got some real weak Republican candidates that I think are very liable to be flipped. And so we're going to be getting involved with that a little bit more, because our focus going out after once we start hitting the door knocking, we're going to be, primarily focused as an Indivisible group at the federal level. But, we're pretty bright. And so I think, being aware of the Senate district that we're door knocking in and helping that particular representative or senator that's seeking to retain their seat or flip the seat, we want to be able to speak to that when we're at the door as well. And so we're inviting all of the folks that are running for office to show up at our meetings so that they can be recognized and our membership can get to know who they are so that they know who to vote for when they go to the polling station.
So, Mark, if people want to get involved, they want to find out when those meetings are. I mean, obviously, we've listed a few of them here, but probably when folks are driving, they don't have their pen and paper going that they can write that stuff down. Where can they find more information and get involved?
Well, our Facebook pages remain our best way to contact us. We have two pages, a public page, which the name is just IREB, and then our closed group page, which is the full name spelled out, Indivisible Resistance of Egan Burnsville. If you search for either one of those, then you'll be able to ask to be joined, and we'll add you right away. And then we have an event calendar, daily postings. It's a very active group. There's something going on all the time. So it'll keep you advised as to what's going on in the resistance with us.
Okay. Well, Mark, we'll have to check in with you again as we get closer to caucuses and definitely after to find out what happens and what kind of experience you and the other folks from IREB had.
All right. Well, thank you, Mike. I appreciate the time to explain what we got going on.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mark. Folks, we're going to take a break here, but when we get back, I want to tell you about some of the crazy claims that were being made in Alabama that a judge didn't listen to. But it says a lot about what the Republican Party is willing to go to say that there's voter fraud. We'll talk about that next year on the Mike McEntee Show.
Back to where I belong. Freeway, freeway, take me home. Back to where I belong.
Auto Technical's fundraising vehicle sale. Our three mechanics have been busy getting cars and trucks ready for the Friday-Saturday fundraiser sale. Come take a test drive. Take it to your mechanic. You will be impressed by the quality and pricing. $1,500 to $4,000 Friday and Saturday. A good bet is AutoTech. AutoTech.org. 651-646-7826. 651-646-7826.
Heirloom Kitchen and Bar is your every occasion restaurant, providing uncommonly good farmhouse cuisine in a neighborhood setting. Heirloom's current menu highlights include cider glazed pork jowl with crab apple puree, smoked potato and Brussels sprouts, and cauliflower cheddar soup with chow chow and milkweed capers. And why not order something off of Heirloom's sustainable organic wine list? Heirloom Kitchen and Bar is located off Creighton and Marshall Avenue and online at heirloomstpaul.com. Heirloom St. Paul. Food matters.
This is Dan Brooks, Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor with RBC Wealth Management. For the past 19 years, I've been managing wealth for individuals, institutions, and corporate retirement plan sponsors. Throughout my career, I have seen common traits in successful investors. They include the courage to be diversified, the willingness to work with a professional, the discipline to follow a plan, and patience. I welcome the opportunity to help contribute to your financial success. Call me at 612-371-2396.
No matter what your taste, you'll find the music you're looking for at the Electric Fetus. Pick from rock, pop, international, roots music, and so much more on CD and vinyl. Or create your own compilation of favorites with the exclusive Mix and Burn CD station, only available at the Electric Fetus. Dust off your vinyl or just make some space by turning your unwanted music into cash. The used selection changes daily, so check out the new arrivals often. 2000 4th Avenue South in Minneapolis and online at efetus.com.
Welcome back to the Mike McIntyre Show here on AM 950. Roy Moore, if you were listening to the news this morning, you would have heard that he had filed an emergency request to stop the certification of the Alabama U.S. Senate election that was going to happen this morning. Well, after a judge read what he said and just said no. And after the judge rejected the last-ditch lawsuit, Alabama election officials have officially declared Democrat Doug Jones the winner of the special Senate election held earlier this month. Jones defeated Republican Roy Moore by about 22,000 votes on December 12th and became the first Democratic Senate victory in a quarter century in Alabama. Now, of course, as you remember, Moore was dogged by accusations of sexual misconduct involving teenage girls that occurred decades ago. He refused to concede the race and filed that last-ditch lawsuit yesterday, saying there were voting irregularities that needed to be investigated. Voting irregularities. And I'm laughing because of some of the ones that were put forward. The Alabama Secretary of State John Merrill says his office found no evidence of voter fraud. I repeat, no evidence of voter fraud. But this one, he cited a case that was very concerning to a lot of people. Again, this is the Secretary of State John Merrill. And Merrill described the reports of a town with 2,200 residents where more than 5,000 votes were recorded. That supposedly happened south of Birmingham in a town called Bordelama. And he says that's very, very frightening to think that that occurred, except for one very important fact. There is no town or community in the state of Alabama called Bordelama. It was all fictitious. It was all made up. It was just a lie that started on the internet. And this is where we are these days. People will retweet and resend things if they think it's... No, not if they think it's true. If they want to believe it's true. I believe that must be true. I want it to be true. And therefore, I'm going to share it with other people to show that I support it. And this is how this kind of junk keeps getting circulated around. I don't even know if you pointed out to somebody that there was no town of Bordelama. And I'm sure some people did in the comments on these things in Facebook, that they would go, well, it doesn't matter. There was voter fraud anyhow. I just know that it has to be true. This is kind of where we are in America. But luckily, that doesn't work when you get to, at least right now, the courts and the Attorney General's office, but the Secretary of State's office in Alabama, at least now. We can start getting concerned as our courts continue to be infiltrated with judges that, frankly, are not qualified, people who don't even know what basic law is that the Trump administration has been, you know, promoting to these positions. We've had 12 district judges approved here in record time because Republicans held those open during the Obama administration and then move very quickly to fill them after they get rid of the rule that, senators could object to these things. So that's what's happening in the court system. That was the last line here, the court system, on, you know, this whole fictitious voter fraud question. Next time it may not be there. Now, talking about other things that the Trump administration has made up, you may have remembered Wednesday that the AT&T announced that they had $1,000 bonuses for all AT&T employees and that they were the result of corporate tax cuts passed in Congress last week. But the big payout was really to Donald Trump's ego. AT&T was already in talks with its union to give holiday bonuses, and the union told the Daily Beast that. The telecom's GOP-friendly press release makes it the latest company to praise Trump's legislative agenda when they need a big favor from the White House. The AT&T announcement comes 1 week after the company reached a new contract agreement with its workers. The contract came after a year of pressure from the workers' union, the Communication Workers of America. But in the past month, the CWA also pushed AT&T to add bonuses based on the GOP's promises of middle-class prosperity under the tax bill. So this came from pressure by the union, not the president. But, you know, the AT&T will gladly say, hey, Donald Trump, we did this because of you. And by the way, can you just approve that merger that we want to have? Yeah, that's where we are today. And, you know, I usually don't reply to stuff on social media that's just way offline. You know, you can follow me, by the way, on Twitter at Mike M. Show. The White House, you know, tweets out all sorts of stuff that you just go, oh, that's not true. The other day, the White House tweeted out, returning money from Washington to the people is the clearest sign our leaders can give that they take this responsibility seriously. And it gives a link to what it says are tax cuts that are making America great again. And I, you know, the frame on that is that by cutting taxes, we are somehow making America better. And I think that we really forget what taxes are about. And so I did respond on Twitter. I said, actually, spending taxes on things we need and can't do individually, but we can do collectively, like providing health care to everybody who needs it, would show that you're taking your leadership responsibility seriously. That's what government is. It's the things that we can't do individually, but we can do collectively. That maybe sometimes we don't have the will to do individually, but we can do collectively. That's what government is about. And when we decide that that's not what it's about, when it's all about individuals, it's all about everyone here doing the best they can by themselves, that's when we start to fail. That's when we fall to what we were talking about with Jack Rice, this idea that, you know, the United States is this country that all the rules do not apply to us because we're so great that we cannot fail, that dictators cannot rise in our midst because, you know, that just doesn't happen. We are a democracy. Well, we've learned that we have a blind spot and that we need to pay attention to that. And if we don't do something different, if we don't work towards, you know, maintaining our democracy, if we are not vigilant, it can go away. It can go away. And it has happened in other places. You have to look no further in history than the Roman Empire to know what happened there. The music means that is the end of today's show. Tomorrow is the last show of the year. And so we are going to ask you to play our game tomorrow called That Was the Year That Wasn't. You get to call in and guess what the real headlines were and weren't. That's tomorrow at 4:00. We'll be back then. See ya.